Welcome aboard, Brendan.
Buongiorno, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is back, episode 171. It's a fine Tuesday in America. I'm assuming it's Tuesday in other places, too. It might actually be Wednesday in even other countries. Or it's whatever day you're listening to this show, because that's how the internet works and podcasting works.
If those other countries are already on Wednesday, they don't count.
Yeah. But this Tuesday, we're recording the Not a Thing podcast. We are hot on the heels of last week's Bakhtun in review. I'm glad for all the folks that were able to catch that and let us know how we're doing this year. This is Bakhtun. I think we're doing okay. We'll know in about 45 or 50 minutes or so after we record this episode. But
I'm calling the shot. We're going to crush it.
Excellent. Well, we will begin with something that is not a thing. Clearly not a thing. This is an idea that is being floated by airlines. And I think historically, you can just say it's not a thing if it has to do with air travel, and it's going to be mentioned on our show. In this case, we're talking about seat upgrades. So if you've ever flown and requested a seat upgrade, they will generally make you pay for them if the flight is if it's early, they allocate whatever seat, but you can get economy plus or maybe even business class if you want to upgrade your seat for a fair amount of money. But there also is a standby list for seat upgrades if you want to just if you just want to sit in a better seat. And sometimes they will give those away if the flight isn't full, which occasionally happens. They don't always overbook every flight. Some airlines are testing out the idea of auctioning those seats off. So you can, in a couple markets, and I don't remember exactly where, but they are going to test it in Las Vegas, I believe, which I think is, they want like a high volume airport. That's probably going to be one of them.
And a bunch of drunk people.
Right. And the hope is that people will bid on upgraded seats. So in addition to buying your ticket and paying whatever ridiculous fees and taxes are related to that, which don't show up until it's much too late after you've already decided which one to buy, now you can add on an upgrade bid, which they are hoping will show on a screen in the gate area, so you can watch your bid progress over time to see if you will get one of the coveted upgradable spots, if there are any. I think this is ridiculous. It's it's essentially you're bidding on the chance to be upgraded, and it just makes air travel even more kind of annoying and competitive and cutthroat for the people that are already kind of annoyed that they have to travel in the kind of subhuman conditions that is air travel these days. So not a thing, at least from my point of view. Have you ever been upgraded, Brendan?
No, never even had the option. Not that I fly that often, but no, not even.
Yeah,
not even once.
I was upgraded to Economy Plus once. It was in a plane where there was a couple. I was sitting in the row right behind the exit row, and there was a couple that somehow got split up in the way that the seats were doled out, and rather than move. They asked if anyone, in my row would be willing to move into the exit row in order to let the couple sit next to each other. And I did. I was flying alone at the time. Otherwise, that probably would have been bad. But it was nicer. It was a nice kind of thing. I know my sister used to fly standby when she was going to college. So we had a we have an uncle that at one time worked for one of the airlines as a mechanic, and employees get some number of like free standby tickets to use for themselves or family, and every once in a while my sister would get them so she could fly home. And the way those worked was that you're on standby and you get whatever thing you get, but because it's a free ticket, and because you might end up in business or first with it, which apparently happened maybe 50% of the time for her, they actually have a dress code where you have to look a certain way in order to be considered to get those standby tickets if it's in business or first, which I think is ridiculous. Because I don't know, it's not like it's not like it's super glamorous flying even in business or first. I always found it weird that if you're in business or first, you get to sit down first before everyone else, but then everyone else still has to walk past you and glare at you the whole time. I can't imagine
that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe
I've never sat there.
Yeah. Maybe if I sat in business or first, I would know how that felt, but I don't know. But upgrading seats, I'm sure is a thing. Upgrading it via an auction system, not a thing. I think air travel is miserable enough. Let's not add like some horrible like bidding war on top of it.
They already say it's like a cattle call. There's no reason you should also make it a cattle auction. We are people.
Very nice, very nice. Oh, speaking of treating people like people, the federal government has reversed I think it's a 20-year, it might even be 30-year policy just recently regarding needle exchange. And this is being hailed as a big win for HIV prevention in particular. Intravenous drug use is one of the major vectors for HIV transmission, and exchanging needles for intravenous drug users it has been a thing for a while. It's just that federal funding was never allocated to it because of a law that banned it. And I believe it was last week, it may have been a little before, they lifted that ban to allow for federal funding to go towards needle exchange programs for intravenous drug users. And I think this is really one of those instances where you're treating people like people. A lot of the reservations against this is that it might reduce the spread of HIV/AIDS, but the other side of the coin is that you're encouraging drug use. And the article that we'll share, I mean, it does show that there is some kind of mixed research about how it is put into effect. But one of the other things that came out of the lifting of this ban is that the ban itself actually specifically prohibited federal funds to be distributed, even for researching if those things worked or not. And it really is the kind of a harm reduction action. And I think harm reduction is one of those, it's hard to do in an absolute way. I mean, I think lawmakers seem to think only in black and white. And I think people don't really work that way. I think that's a known thing. And harm reduction kind of treats people like people with all of the kind of stuff associated, good and bad, and then dealing with the fallout of that in a more realistic way. So good for the federal government on this one, and pulling that together. I think it was actually Congress agreed on something good this time. This is amazing.
Yeah, that's impressive. I'm always against things that are put into law that don't allow for even the study of whether that thing should be a thing.
Yeah. Right. I think what lawmakers might think of as common sense, I don't know if that's really true or not. I feel like
I don't care about the common sense of a politician. I care about statistics and empirical data.
Right. One point for studies and empirical data and getting people kind of the help that they need. One really interesting thing about that was mentioned in the article was that when news media would go to cover like a needle exchange site, a lot of the folks they said were surprised by how they weren't like, you know, drug flop houses, but actually, you know, buildings where people were getting education and drug testing and other forms of like economic development. And so I think it really does change the way that people can empathize about a problem. If people are, you know, again, treated like people.
That should always be a thing.
Hear, hear.
I think that's the official stance of the podcast is people should be treated like people.
kind of in the vein of people.
Vein.
Yeah. Well, not quite there. We're on okay. But in the vein of people being being people and all of the kind of things that they're subject to, all of the urges that they're subject to, as people get more into their devices, into phones and tablets and computers, especially anything with a screen, a problem that's been cropping up is that's being studied now and is that the effect of essentially having light streamed into your eyeballs for much longer than is normal. Normal being how it used to be when, you know, the sun went up and then went down in the evening. And you know, there have been studies about how this affects your brain chemistry and your ability of your body to regulate your energy output and stuff like that, because if we evolve to understand like the day-night cycle, are we throwing it off by things like artificial lighting and stuff like that? And I think artificial lighting, I think we've mostly gotten used to, although I still sleep in the dark. That's still a thing. But what is new and in the last, you know, 30, 40 years is the advent of a lot of computer screens that are essentially putting light directly into people's eyes, and increasingly so over much more timeline. And I know I'm guilty of using my phone, you know, in bed well after my bedtime, as it were. And there are studies that show that blue light, specifically, of which is a lot of the light in device screens, can throw off your brain's kind of perception of time, and then interrupts things like sleep patterns and stuff like that. And there are a few apps that have been released that kind of work with this, and there are ways to kind of modify your computer to make this better. I used one for a while called F.Lux, and it was, I think it's pronounced flux, but it's it would, after like sunset, it would kind of take the blue slowly out of your screen, so it would be more orange, kind of a warmer light, kind of a dusk kind of thing, and it supposedly was better for my eyes and stuff like that. But Apple announced in their new version of iOS, which is coming sometime this year, I think March or May is the time frame. It will have a, they're calling it the night shift mode, which will do that. It looks like it will just tone down the amount of blue in the screens to kind of make it easier on the eyes when viewing things at night.
Well, it's interesting that F-Lux had a app for the iPhone, which Apple then shut down and removed from the Apple Store so that they could do this.
Well, their rationale at the time, if I'm remembering right, was that in order to get that app onto your phone to do anything, because it had to modify how the screens work essentially in all apps, not just when you're running the F-Lux app. It required your phone to be jailbroken, and Apple generally doesn't like that kind of thing. So they pulled it, but you're right, they totally introduced the feature into the native OS. So yeah, I'm sure they're not paying the folks for F-Lux for all their development, like, kind of skills and time. but it's still, I think it's still a thing. I know that even I wish there was more even just control over brightness when I'm using my phone or iPad at night. It's just real bright. I mean, even with the brightness all the way down, I use a Reddit reader called Alien Blue, and it has a night mode, which makes everything, instead of kind of black on white with a white background, it makes everything kind of white or gray on black, which is a much easier on my eyes when I'm trying to read. Although it still does have a fair amount of kind of light. I mean, even a completely black LCD screen is still emitting light. Like, you can still, like, almost walk around in the dark with a screen like that. So you know, they just have to figure out a way to do it without any kind of light emission at all. I think that's called books.
Yeah, but it's not just books, though, because you're watching TV shows and movies.
Right. I don't know how they'd have to beam them into your brain. Then you're not using your eyes at all.
Then we're living in the world of Batman Forever. No, thank you.
Yes, no, thank you. But I do look forward to the night shift mode. Hopefully that doesn't mean that I use the screens more at night too, because then we have to worry about how much brain power I'm using in the middle of the night.
I'm sure, you know, that actually, the Batman Forever thing, I want to go back to that real quick. That made me think. Sorry to take us on a tangent here. I try not to do this often. But people gave The Dark Knight Rises a bunch of shit and make fun of the character Bane.
Uh-huh.
Played by Tom Hardy, who is an amazing actor.
Yeah.
And they forget that there was a Batman movie where the villains were Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee Jones trying to overact Jack Nicholson. And that wasn't even the worst one.
Yeah. Yeah.
People have short memories.
Oh, so speaking of The Dark Knight, it's interesting you mentioned that. There's a security company out of Palo Alto which is making a bunch of security robots, and the name of the names of the robots is the brand is called Nightscope. Night spelled with a K, so K-N-I-G-H-T Scope, and
Knigget,
and they're bona fide autonomous robots. You can tell where we're going with this one, but
We should have put this at the beginning of the show with the knot thing.
But I think it's kind of interesting because the robots are meant to be not exactly security guards, because they can't really do anything. They
don't have arms.
They will rove around and patrol an area, and they're built with a 360 degree infrared camera, so they can see a bunch of stuff. They have sensors, they have speakers, and they rove around a property probably in a patrol kind of way, and will relay stuff back to a security force, like an actual, you know, human security force that can do things. It's interesting because they're making them, and they're not selling them, they're renting them. So if you want your site protected by these Nightscope things, you have to pay, I think it's $6.25 an hour, which is less than minimum wage. So robots are... okay, so there's a lot of things wrong with this. autonomous robots. Okay, one, right? Two, they're working for less than minimum wage. If there was any more of a, like, robots are taking our jobs kind of moment in this show, it's this one. And third, they pretty much look like Daleks. I mean, they're kind of squat and round. And the only thing they don't have...
It's like a Dalek fucked an egg timer.
Right. The only thing they don't have are the really silly arms and the kind of plunger thing sticking out of them. But that's probably V2, you know, once they kind of work on them a little bit. So this is pretty much not a thing. I think there's a lot of... there's a lot of interesting in this, but I think you know, companies are gonna think this is a colossal waste of money. I'm especially looking forward to all the people that are running around like trying to get pictures with these things as they're rolling around. You know, you're gonna see like kick me signs on them and graffiti, and it's gonna be great. But
until the second version comes out with tasers built in.
Yeah. So, you know, just be aware it can see 360 degrees. So that's all around. And Apple, another bit in the news, Apple bought a company not too long ago that does facial, not just facial recognition, but facial sentiment recognition. So it can tell if you're kind of on a scale if you're kind of happy, sad, or angry. And I feel like adding these two technologies together is just like asking for thought crime, you know, as a thing. So not a thing. Robots still, you know, you gotta take things with a grain of salt with robots. So moving
some grains of rock salt when you shoot it with a shotgun. Yeah. Although you probably want to use something stronger than rock salt.
I think I'd go with slugs.
Yeah, slugs. Maybe buckshot.
Maybe buckshot. Maybe. I mean, you want to go through these things is the problem.
The candy cane load.
Yeah. Yeah. So moving from one questionable technology to another.
Another load to another.
Or rather the lack of one.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's some interesting technology coming out of, I want to say it's England.
Is it German?
It was German. Okay, of course. Oh, those guys are so freaky. Anyway, this is a new bit of technology specifically for men. It's meant to take the place of the time-honored vasectomy. So vasectomies, if you don't know, are a way to infertilize a man by cutting of the vas deferens. That's the vas in vasectomy. It's a small kind of tube that runs from the testicles to the rest of the plumbing in the in kind of the male kind of reproductive system, and prevents specifically just the sperm from getting into everything, really. And this is a fairly kind of common and effective surgery, but this one German surgeon has built and tested a device, and I say tested because I believe he had them implanted in himself as the first subject. So it's still in the test phase because he's the only person that's tested it. But what he's engineered this essentially it's a valve that fits over the or in line with the vas deferens, and there's a switch. So you flick the switch, and the valve is open, or you flick the switch and the valve is closed.
I don't know if you want to use flick. No one wants to get flicked in the scrotum.
So that's the interesting thing, is the thing that is the valve has the switch built into it, and it's a little confusing from the photos, but it looks like there's not just one switch, but there's two, because there's two vas deferens, and it's the article and the description of how it is used is rife with all sorts of problems. I don't even know where to start, honestly. So it sounds interesting in that, you know, it's essentially it's a reversible vasectomy, because currently vasectomy is essentially one way. Once you have a vasectomy, you can't father children anymore. So
unless you get a reverse vasectomy,
which I'm pretty sure.
Other thing.
Yeah, is not. It's, I guess
it's a lot more complicated than flipping a switch.
Right, right. So the interesting thing about the switch flipping and everything else is that the I don't even know what the market is for this. It's like, if you want the benefits of the vasectomy, but you want to be able to reverse it, is what it seems to be. I think the way that the article kind of reads makes it sound like you can change the switch whenever you want, and that's pretty much a bad idea if you actually want the benefits of the vasectomy. That is not impregnating people, because as I was saying earlier, the vas deferens stops sperm from getting from the testicles to the next step in the chain, but there's a lot more plumbing that goes between there and everything else. And it, if you read the fine print, it takes, I think it said 3 to 6 months if you flip the switch to turn it off before it is actually off.
But I mean, that's a much better turnaround time than the alternatives that you currently have.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting, I just think that there's too much potential for the switches to be messed with inappropriately.
Yeah, how are they labeled? Do you have to get a tattoo?
Well, that was also funny in the article, because it says, oh, it's simple. You press down towards the abdomen because that's where the sperm flows. And you look in the picture and it's like, no, towards the abdomen from there is up. How do you choose down from that direction?
I think they have to have a pretty strong pamphlet to come with that.
Yeah. It needs to be, I think it should be an external safety, like on a gun. It should take two hands to activate and deactivate. Yeah.
Actually, no, it should take four hands.
It should take, right. And they should
It's like the keys on the nuclear submarine. Like, yes. You have to flip both switches at the exact same time.
Right.
And have it designed in a way so you can't do it yourself. You need someone there to assist you. That seems more reasonable to me.
It does. I think by making it a switch, especially the way it looks, I mean, it looks like an on-off switch for a light. I mean, I think...
Yeah, I'd just be sitting there flipping that all day.
Right, that's the problem. That's the problem.
I sat down too hard and accidentally flipped.
Right, anyone with, like, nervous hands is gonna break that thing, you know, within...
Yeah, you see what happened to the pen? Yeah. A pen with a clicker on the end of it?
Right. There's all sorts of problems here. I think it deserves further study, for sure, but...
That's not a hill I'm looking to take.
Yeah.
In the first wave, I'm glad this guy did it to himself first, and we'll see how it goes from there. Maybe in 10 years.
Right. Well, in 10 years, it'll be, you can control it with an app. It's kind of Bluetoothed in.
Bluetooth enabled balls.
Yeah. Blue balls tooth. No, no, you don't want teeth near balls. No,
that's horrible marketing, Alan.
No, let's move away from that. Let's move away to something lighter and happier. i.e. the movie The Revenant. I don't know where else to go. We're going to enter spoiler territory, if only for a little bit. I ended up seeing The Revenant yesterday. In the afternoon, in the daytime. So I had a lot of time to process it before I went to bed. It was great.
Yeah, so did I.
It was that was a rough movie, man.
Yeah, intense. It was very that's just uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think so uncomfortable.
Yeah,
just from a physical standpoint, like, oh, that poor guy.
Yeah. It starts out very, very, I mean, the whole movie is actually shot gorgeously. There's so many moments of especially of nature, just, you know, long shots of like clouds rolling over mountains and the beginning with the stream of water that they're like walking through, and the tree roots are making like ripples in the water. Just gorgeous environments and really well done cinematography. And then just...
Well, it's Chivo. It's Emmanuel Lubezki, who's mm-hmm. probably the greatest cinematographer in the history of film.
And it's
so
just...
not surprising.
Yeah. It's just fantastic kind of environments. And then equally fantastic people getting just really, really killed. I mean, this changes over in, I think it's the first, maybe even 5 minutes, if not the first 10 minutes. It goes from like huge idyllic expanses of like early America, and then horrible like tribal infighting and people getting shot with arrows and guns, and it's all
it's
flintlock guns, so it's they're single shot, so there's no, it's not even like the multi-bullet gore that that you can execute today, and it's still horrific.
No, it's the pelt trapper version of Saving Private Ryan in that opening scene. It's very similar,
yeah,
to the opening scene.
Yeah, it's a really good point, actually. Except in trying to come off, instead of coming off of a boat to land,
they're trying to get onto a boat.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But so, and then after the adrenaline kind of thins out from that, then you have a really intense bear mauling sequence.
That was so well shot. That bear looked great.
Yeah.
And it was so vicious. Like, it was uncomfortable at times.
And yet not really,
not overly gory or graphic.
Yeah. And the bear did not seem especially angry. It was more like, this is in my way and I'm going to deal with it. And it seemed sort of every day. I mean, it didn't even seem menacing. It was just like, this is what a bear does, kind of a thing. And
that is what bears do. They're godless killing machines. No, that's not true. They're beautiful animals.
Yes.
And there is justification in the movie as to why the bear attack happens.
Yes. Yes.
Which is the same reason that most bear attacks happen. So.
Don't mess with bear babies, period.
No, just walk away.
Right.
If you ever see a bear cub, just walk away.
Yeah.
Don't investigate. Don't mess with it. Just walk away.
Yeah.
Quickly. But don't run.
Right.
But walk quick.
Yeah, they can smell fear also, by the way. But and then it just like keeps piling on. There's so much stuff that happens to Leonardo DiCaprio in this movie. It's really this journey of being just like chewed up and spit out multiple times by nature, by people, by like multiple groups of people. I thought maybe because the Revenant kind of invokes for me like it's the thing that has come back is what it literally means if you're translating stuff, and generally it's used in, you know, in the case of like someone coming back from the dead, and he dies and comes back at least three times, maybe even four, I think, during the course of the movie. And I don't mean literally dies, but there's a lot of symbolism in how things are shot and things are done, in which he there's this like death and rebirth, like multiple times. There's the death and rebirth of you know, surviving the attack at the beginning. There's again of the bear, the thing with the horse, being in that that wooden structure that the Pawnee like builds for him, and then striking his way out of it. There's just this like theme of him being, you know, dying and being born again, and you know, by the end of the movie, where he's just like, he has one purpose, and that's it. And when he goes to do it, you believe it. You believe that he can do it because of all the just shit he's been through.
Yeah.
And
it was beautiful. Yeah. And it was harrowing, and I don't know if I need to see it again.
Yeah, that's the
but
the
it was one, good. Like, that's the it's one not going to be my top movie.
Yeah.
But it's real good. It was really well made.
Yeah. And I thought Tom Hardy just disappeared as his character. He's like, I thought for a while that he had kind of like a mange or a lice thing going on, which is why his hair was
missing. So did I.
And then when he just kind of offhand tells the story, which he does like multiple times, he's just this guy like telling stories to people about how like fucked up his life is, and it's really fucked up. So I mean, as a kind of villain character, you get insights into him, and it's not made so you sympathize with him. It's made to like kind of just justify how horrific he acts, or the way he acts, and how he kind of does things. I thought he was great, and if I didn't know that was Tom Hardy, I don't think I would have been able to tell. Just everyone with kind of that, like 6 months of I've been living away from anything that looks like water, clean water.
Yeah, it's all pretty gross.
Yeah. But I think between this and Hateful Eight, it pretty much means I have to have some kind of huge animal pelt. I think that's.
Oh, yeah. Both of those movies made me feel cold watching them.
Exactly. Yeah.
I didn't want to take my jacket off when I was watching The Revenant. Even though it was starting to get warm, I was like, no, it's going to be too cold if I take it off.
Yeah. It's funny. I actually had the same thought, because I, walking from my car outside, it was, you know, genuinely cold outside, and I have, well, it's California cold, so it's probably like 50.
Yeah, but, not genuinely cold. It's California cold.
But I had, you know, I had a jacket on, and I usually will take off a jacket and kind of bundle it into like a lumbar support pillow when I'm in a theater. But I didn't, and I was like, no, it's cold in here. Like there's a number of sequences when I was worried they were going to do some kind of horrible thing with frostbite, and they didn't, thankfully. I was actually pleasantly surprised by that. But it was a really, really well done movie. But I think you're right, the summation of it was great to see once is appropriate. And I think it was great to see in a theater, especially. Just it definitely has the scope and the weight of a movie that you should see in a theater. So I would recommend people to catch it, even you know, it's I don't think I'm pretty sure they're not doing any kind of crazy stuff where it's in like IMAX theaters, but I would recommend watching it and sitting close. It is a gory movie. There's certainly a lot of stuff that that will make you uncomfortable if you're at all kind of turned off by gore. But the level of intensity is off the scale for every, pretty much every sequence is just it's as close as you can feel to being in like a, I mean, I got this reaction when I watched The Dark Knight. You just feel like you've been in a fight after you watch this movie. You're just drained and tired and cold. it's an intense movie. I think and I don't think there were any I don't know. It's hard for me to think of negatives, actually, other than it's real long. It's like 2.5 hours.
The third act I thought dragged a bit because at that point you know what's going to happen.
Sure.
And it's just a matter of getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a couple points, I think, when it's a little slow, but I mean, there are payoffs for everything as it goes.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I think it's it was definitely worth the full price ticket I paid. As tough as that movie is,
uh-huh. I felt better walking out of that than I did walking out of The Big Short, which I also just saw.
Oh,
that it just makes you sick and angry. About the 2008 financial crisis.
Yes.
So mad.
Corporate America. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, I might wait to see that one.
Do you have a strong urge to start hanging bankers? That Bane guy was really on to something.
So
I realize I'm coming off very pro-Bane in this episode. And we got Tom Hardy in this movie, and right.
It
all comes back.
Exactly.
Time is a flat circle.
I think one of the fun things that kind of came out of it is actually not related to it. I got in the trailers ahead of it. I got the trailer for Hail Caesar.
I'm very
excited. I mean, Coen Brothers, how can you not see it? It's going to be great.
Yeah, that was the best trailer I've seen. It was nice to see not a superhero movie trailer.
Yeah, I did get Deadpool in front of it.
Yeah, but you can't complain about Deadpool because it's Deadpool, and that's going to be great. Yeah. Or I'll be eating my words in a month. We'll see.
We'll see. It at least should not be the same rhythm as like every other superhero movie, so I'm excited for that. Kind of in the same way it was reusing a lot of kind of James Bondy spy movie tropes, but it was not the same kind of flow, so it was still unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really been the theme of a lot of them. Not a lot. I can only think of two right now, but movies that I've seen recently that I've really enjoyed. So both The Revenant and Hateful Eight. I don't. And I think a lot of it is because I avoided a lot of the media ahead of it. But I think they're also just made in a way where you can't tell what's going to happen next. It's not a clear, like, kind of through line for what's going to happen, and all the beats that are in between. In The Revenant, you kind of know what's going to happen, but like everything that happens up to that point is still kind of a surprise and a shock. And I think that was just also true with Hateful Eight.
Hateful Eight, I had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah,
that was a nice feeling.
Yeah, Yeah, it is. I think that I'm going to be kind of looking for that more as movies go, to see like what's interesting kind of about them. I've mostly given up on character arcs.
Yes,
they're too programmed. It's too there's too much of a formula around it. So I think just being pleasantly surprised in a movie is going to be my new bar. Well, we will be pleasantly surprised if any folks would like to join us for a show, maybe next week, maybe in the coming weeks. Feel free to let us know, Twitter, Facebook, via the website, all that kind of jazz. We're looking for more guests for 2016. If you'd like to be a guest, just let us know and we'll pull it together. So, Brendan, I will talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.